You're listening to the Home Improvement Show on News Talk Radio, CJAD 800.
Yes, you are. Ken Connors with you this morning for the Home Improvement Show, and of course, sitting in to answer your questions is Walter Assey from Renovco. Walter, good morning.
Good morning, Ken. How are you?
How are you? Full disclosure, Walter is not here.
I'm in a secret location.
At a secret location, absolutely, via Zoom. Walter, how did your week go? You're staying busy?
I'm staying super busy, yeah. I took the kids to Disneyland, so it's a rite of passage to every father to walk in the boiling sun 20,000 steps a day. It's got to get done.
Very, very nice. Well, safe travels to you. If you want to talk to Walter, you have a home renovation project underway or upcoming, and you need a little advice, a little guidance, something that needs to be fixed, you just need to, to ask a couple of questions to set you off on the right foot. Call us now and let us know at 514-790-0800. Again, 514-790-0800. Walter, I think, yes, last week at this time I talked about how many roofing jobs are being done in my neighborhood, and they were all done. These guys, it's amazing how quickly they can get the job done with a large roof to handle.
Well, you kind of have no choice because our weather here is not predictable at all, right? Mm-hmm. So, you can't, if you extend the roof to go over a three-day period of time, you're going to run into trouble. So usually what they do is it's a much bigger team that goes, and most roofs are finished in 1 to 2 days. Yeah. It's a pretty fast job to do.
Like on the front end, they usually start around 7 o'clock in the morning, but they take every last bit of daylight actually to get that job done. So sometimes they work into the early evening, as you said, just to get the job and done in 2 days.
They do long hours. Sometimes they do shorter weeks because, when it rains, obviously they're not allowed and they don't work, but they're also not allowed to work even for smaller things, CSST rules and regulations. So if the roof is wet, they can't work. So, you know, their 7 day week might turn out to be a 3 or a 4 day week. It depends how much rain we have in the forecast, but they do very long hours for sure.
Yeah. Like
it's,
you said,
crazy days for them.
They're at the mercy of the weather. 514-790-0800. If you have a question for Walter from Renovco, we're going to start with Charlie in LaSalle. Hi, Charlie.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Fine. Thank you. Yourself?
I'm good. Yeah. What are you working on and what do you need some advice about?
Well, it's more of a mystery situation in the basement where I have floating floors, like laminated floors. Mm-hmm. For some reason, recently, I'm discovering spores, mold spores, along the whole length of the wall. And I wipe it down with a mold product, and it comes back. And I also removed the floating floor along the wall to see if maybe it was damp underneath. I couldn't find anything. So it's a little bit of a mystery for me. So I'm sort of like Sherlock Holmes trying to find out what's causing it. Any clues?
You're playing detective.
I love mysteries. They're my favorite. So my question is, the spores that you're seeing, are they on the perimeter of the floors between the baseboard and the floors themselves, so between the walls and the floors, or they're all over the floating floor?
They are along the whole wall, but not on the wall itself. It's only on the laminated floor. Like I would say, 6 inches along, up to 6 inches along the border of the wall. And they're small, and they're easy to wipe off. I mean,
But I mean, what color are they?
The black.
Black. Okay. So and you don't have a subfloor underneath, do you?
Yes.
So it's a laminated floor right on cement?
No, there is a, what do you call it, the underlying fabric or material that goes, and then underneath is a concrete slab. Hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So what might be happening is that because you don't have a subfloor, you might have some humidity from the slab itself. What year construction is a duplex?
It's about 1990.
Okay. We should have had some type of geotextile. Now, if you lift a bit the laminate flooring and you look at the cement slab, let me know if you see any chalky residue, like fluorescence. If you see any chalky residue, that means that the slab itself is sending some humidity up. The salt in the cement is pushing through, and that's why you see that chalky substance right on the cement. Now, if that's happening, that will cause spores because that means there's something that is humid below that. Okay, that's why we always say if you have a slab that you're not sure about, build a subfloor to kind of create some type of a shield between your floor and the ambient air that you're breathing, so you don't have these types of issues. That's number one. Number two, walk around that wall, see if there's any evidence of a foundation crack or French drain issues. Okay, now most of the time we don't know that, but seepage does not cause water damage necessarily that fast, meaning you could have some type of droplets that are coming down through some kind of a crack accumulating in one area, and it takes a long time before it actually starts coming out and showing itself to you. So in cases like this, you will see telltale signs, but not necessarily the water that comes with it. A quick way for you to see if there's something going on that wall is you go outside and you see if there's any foundation cracks that are apparent. Maybe it's starting to leak a little bit without you knowing, and that's causing that issue as well. The third thing, okay, is your simple ambient air in the basement. Now you get yourself a hygrometer and you see what is your relative humidity down there. Most people forget to dehumidify their basement, especially in the summer. It's very humid. And any relative humidity that exceeds 60%, just the humidity itself in the air creates spores. And then you will see those mold spores. In your case, you could tell that within seconds. If you are above 60% humidity in that basement, dehumidify immediately. And regardless, you should have a good quality dehumidifier running at all times in order to avoid these issues from happening. Because at a minimum, if you don't see the spores, your basement is going to start smelling musty, and that's what you don't want.
Okay. So, like starting with the easiest thing first, would you suggest that I apply the dehumidifier, take it like step by step and see like and then let's say if it's not the dehumidifier cannot resolve the problem, then the next step would be to, I guess, remove the laminate floors along the whole wall and then verify if there's a issue there and then take it from there step by step.
Actually, what I would do is I would the dehumidifier is non-negotiable. Regardless if you have a problem or not, you have to put it. It sets automatically anyway. So as soon as it gets to a humidity level that is high enough, it will kick in by itself. So you don't need to kind of babysit it yourself. So that will be regardless of what you find, I would do that. Walking around your foundation outside is something that we should do anyways. So I would do these two in conjunction with each other. I would go outside, I will see if there's any cracks, any evidence of any damages to my foundation. If you see one, investigate it further because it will cause you problems later for sure if not causing you now. So that's so these two I would do in conjunction with these other. Now you don't necessarily need to remove your floating floor. What you just need to do is if you take out the baseboard very carefully with a crowbar, cut the silicone, cut the caulking, take out the baseboard. Usually there's about a quarter inch gap between the baseboard and the floor and the wall, between sorry, the laminate floor and your wall, which is enough for you to put your finger and lift the laminate floor without having to go into taking it out. And just look underneath, peek underneath with a strong flashlight to see if you see any efflorescence in this area. If you see any efflorescence, then your cement slab have some humidity issues that have to be rectified.
Charlie, we have to run. I hope that was some help for you this morning.
It was very, very helpful. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Bye now.
My pleasure, sir.
It's 9:16. Let's take a little break here and come back with more calls. 514-790-0800. Call now.
You might just need to tighten a thingamajig on the whatchamacallit. This is the Home Improvement Show on CJAD 800.
That's what I said to my doctor at my last physical. 922, Walter Rassi from Renovco is taking your calls, answering your questions. Call now and grab a line. It's an hour of free advice from an expert and a guy with a lot of years of experience. 514-790-0800. Walter, we're going to go right back to the phone, if you're okay with that. Carl from Côte Saint-Luc is on the line. Hi, Carl.
Good morning.
Good morning. You want to talk about a foundation issue as well, right?
Yes. Looks like today's the day for that. I'm renovating, doing the basement, and I want to add some insulation. So I took all the studs out, and of course, I'm looking at a few cracks near the windows,
yeah,
vertical cracks. And I just want to ask Walter if, other than epoxy or polyurethane, I mean, I know I want to use polyurethane, but I've seen also people putting steel plates. I don't know if you've ever seen that technology, or I've seen them put staples, which is kind of like making grooves and putting these Kevlar, like 10-inch Kevlar, I don't know what to call it, sheets.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen that? And what do you think of that technology or either of those two?
Hmm.
Okay, that's not really a technology. It's more if the foundation technician sees that the crack is wide enough that it will require some reinforcement. That's when we put the steel plates
okay.
in, you know, along with the repair. So that is going to boil down to how wide your crack is, how big it is, how long it is. It's not necessarily important to do if you have just a hairline crack or those small cracks. That you don't need to do it simply by urethane injection. It will do the job. Okay. Now, you know, you had a question, I think, and I cut you off. Carl?
Hello? Yes, I'm still here. I'm listening.
No, Walter yeah. said you had a question, and he cut you off. So just what was the question you were going to ask him?
Well, the question was for the steel plates. I mean, I've seen that. I think it's the easiest to apply versus the staples. So I was wondering, yeah, is it necessary or not? And the crack is really a hairline. But at the top, it's not. It's more like a quarter inch or maybe less. So I was wondering if putting a steel plate, because I want to spray foam, so I just want to make sure that I do the proper thing before I spray foam. So I don't mind adding the steel plates, even if the crack is not as large.
Mm.
Is that
true? I mean, it doesn't hurt to add
exactly,
the steel plate.
Yeah.
But, you know, in most cases, if it's a hairline crack, you don't need to add it. But, I mean, it doesn't really hurt. What's important is, you know, with these types of cracks is that you just very important that it's watertight, especially below grade,
yes,
where you have the hydrostatic pressure.
Yes.
You know, anything above grade is important to inject as well, but it's not as important as what's below grade, because with hydrostatic pressure, the water really sprays in.
Yeah.
You know, so if you feel that you want to do it just as an extra cautionary measure, that's fine. It doesn't really hurt your foundation at all.
Okay. Is
it
specific type of steel plate that you would put? Does it have to be stainless steel? Does it have to be a certain thickness? And then how would you drill it? Like, would you just use it epoxy, like put steel pins and then drill and put epoxy in it?
Are you doing this yourself?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. Well,
actually, we're doing it together,
so,
Walter.
So there's a store called Givesco.
Yes,
they specialize in So they specialize in a lot of these types of materials because it's a specialty store you're looking for. If you want something more a bit like ready to go, I think Home Depot have a foundation kit as well, foundation repair kit that you could buy. Givesco have a bit more specialized stuff. So if you are looking for those steel plates, you're looking for, reinforcement rods and what have you, that's the place that you would want to go to get all of that.
Okay.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Good luck with that, Colonel. Thank you for the call. That frees up a line, too, if you want to talk to Walter at 514-790-0800. It's 926. We're just letting the line settle again, 514-790-0800. Walter, a question. We talked about this last week about kitchen renovations. I have a couple of minutes here, so weigh in on this if you don't mind. How important, when it comes to a kitchen renovation, is planning ahead of your renovation? I guess, you know, because the kitchen is such an important part of the house and the daily routine, I guess you have to sort of plan around things that you're not going to have access to during the course of that renovation.
Well, I'll tell you, I've been in this business for about 30 years, and most of the kitchen jobs that I see are second or third generation kitchen renovation, meaning they've done it during their life in the house a couple of times at least. Now, the main problem why they keep on doing it is because they realize that the first time there was a mistake, the second time there was a mistake, and so on and so forth. Hmm. My advice is, you know, to homeowners, you are not necessarily a kitchen designer or a specialist. Mm-hmm. Don't try to do this, especially a kitchen. A paint job, we could always change over a weekend if we don't like the color. A kitchen, there's a lot of moving parts to it. So, you know, people trying to play contractor, they're playing contractor with their own money. Have a cuisinist, the kitchen specialist, plan it out for you. The planning is what makes the kitchen renovation a successful one. Whether it's in the layout, whether it's in the heights, in the colors, in the fillers where you're going to place them, the corners, the gadgets, the accessories, you name it, right? The sizes of the appliances, you know, things of that nature. The size of the island. I've been to places where the island was so massive, you couldn't even, you know, if your stove breaks down, you can't even take it out and throw it in the garbage,
right?
You know, without demolishing the island that is in the way. Why? It's because whoever planned this did not have the code requirements of circulations for appliances. You have to think long-term. Like, okay, I can pass, it's 2 feet. Yeah, it's 2 feet for you, it's good now, but that stove breaks, it needs 3 feet clearance, for example. So these are the little things that have to be thought about in a kitchen. The materials as well. Mm-hmm. See, when we're doing kitchen renovation, we ask a lot of questions about the cooking habits that the clients have, the age of the children, because there are certain materials that are more resistant to people that use and abuse a kitchen.
Right.
So these are the materials we kind of limit ourselves to. There are others that are a bit cheaper, but they're more designed for people that rarely cook or rarely use their kitchen, and they're nice to look at. It's smaller things like that, but they make a big difference on your budget and on the longevity of your kitchen. The other thing is, kitchen is one of the renovations that is guaranteed to bring back the money into your house if you ever sell it. So you want to make sure that 4, 5, 7, 10 years down the line, that kitchen still looks as good to make your money back if you're planning to sell in a few years down the line. So that's how you should plan it, things that are timeless. You can't, for example, put, I don't know, a pink kitchen or a, you know, even the darks, we stay away from them. Even when they were in style, we're staying away from them. Reason being, not everybody likes dark, but everybody is okay with earth tones, for example.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
You know, so, and again, if you're going to go dark, that's great, but then buy materials that can be sanded down and restained to the potential new homeowner's taste in the future rather than they have to rip everything out and restart from scratch.
Very good. Walter Rassi from Renovco, another half hour to go, so call now and you can talk to him and pick his brain, 514-790-0800. We're coming back right after the news.
Whether you're handy or all thumbs, you're listening to the Home Improvement Show on CJAD 800.
At 9:35, it's Ken Connors along with Walter Rassi, who's actually in Florida and on Zoom this morning. Walter, good morning. Welcome back to the second half of the show.
Good morning.
Walter, you're not down in Florida to take part in that rocket launch to the moon today, are you?
I am. They had a few issues in the layout, in the cabinetry there.
You're doing what you can do. Very good.
Yes.
Let's get back to the phone here. Tim is in St. Lazare to talk to you, Walter. Tim, hi.
Hey, good morning. How's everybody?
We're all good. You want to talk about changing your oil furnace?
Yeah, I really want to talk about the guidelines. You had it on a show quite a while ago.
Yeah.
The government's changed the rules in regards to maintaining or keeping an oil furnace. Now, my technician came a couple weeks ago to clean my oil furnace, and he had said that there's a little bit of a loophole that if I was actually to put in a thermal pump, I could still maintain keeping my oil furnace. I just really wanted to get some information, Walter. Hmm. I'm really confused as to the rules.
I have not heard about that loophole. What I know is that you're allowed to keep the oil furnace as long as you're repairing the furnace, but you can't replace it. Now, having said that, what they probably going to do is they're going to phase it out gradually. I think 2023 is what they were aiming, but they're hoping by 2025, 2026, that, you know, most people are going to have, you know, by that time, gotten rid of their oil furnaces. Now, you can still be, if you're, how old is the oil furnace that you have right now?
Oh, it's only 20 years old.
Only 20 years old. Okay, and still in good shape?
Oh, yeah, it's in wonderful shape.
Okay, so, I mean, you don't need to replace it if it's not broken. That's the thing. So if you don't have issues and it still can be fixed, then you could actually keep it till the end of the life of the furnace itself. And if you are going to replace to something in the future, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you are going to replace
it to something. Oh, sorry. Excuse me, Walter. Yeah, no, I'd like to keep it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to keep it, but I just want to make sure that I'm not breaking any laws by keeping it.
No, you're not. I believe what happened was that there was a backlash, and then they kind of modified the law to give a bit more time for people. Because what they did is they only gave 2 years. Now,
right.
Just imagine supply chain issues, demand, everybody that have an oil furnace. So there was an issue there, and they you know, that's what they keep on doing. Sometimes what they actually like to do is they hit you with a very unrealistic type of a deadline, get those people to rush to change, and then they have a backlash. They do that all the time. And then they modify to give extensions and more time and so on and so forth. So in your case, you can drag it on as long as, you know, you're not in need to replace the oil furnace. Now, at one point, you're going to have to do it for sure.
Okay.
And if that point comes, I mean, you can always look at natural gas or propane. My favorite personally is propane type if you want to have a bioenergy type heating.
Mm-hmm.
Propane is what I would recommend, just because the way it heats is very good, and you could still keep your cheap tariffs from hydro for having bioenergy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
that's actually good, quite interesting.
Yeah.
because I also have a 21 watt propane generator, so I could actually use that as a backup source as well. That's very interesting. Okay. Great information.
Yeah,
thank
well, that's
so
what that's definitely what I would go with. That's 100%. You know, if you have that, that's awesome. And the thing is, you know, the new heat pumps can work up to minus 30. Some of the new heat pumps, and that's what I would go with. They can work up to minus 30, and they work beautifully. So your furnaces kick in very rarely in the winter. I mean, it's how often do we have temperature below minus 30? Not often, maybe a day or two the whole winter. So that's why it might be even, you know, it might be even more economical for you long term to have that type of heat for you know, for savings and for comfort as well. It's a cleaner type of heating energy. Problem with,
right.
with oil, it's kind of clean.
Because I know the technician had mentioned too, because I also have an air conditioning unit, right? Central air conditioning coupled with my furnace. And he said if you change the air conditioning and put in a thermal pump, to your point, because the newer systems really kick in at minus 30 and whatnot, that I could actually save a lot of money and the furnace would very rarely work.
That is correct, which is a win-win for you, really, because, you know, you're saving money and you're kind of keeping and conserving the heat, the life of your furnace for a long, long time, because it doesn't have to work as much. So you know, I would study the savings, look at your heating bills, and you might be surprised to see that you might be saving a lot of money per year just to update. New furnaces, anyways, they are way more efficient than the old ones. So that already you're going to have a lot more to gain out of that. Plus, mm-hmm. you're going to have a lot more comfort. If you upgrade your power to what you need in today's standards, you might find that, okay, you know, I needed that much more power than, you know, what I had, and so on and so forth. And the comfort in your house, you know, more often than not, we see people have 2 ton and they need a 3 ton type of a heat mm-hmm. pump. And that's why, you know, they have it on all summer. The machine overworks itself and they're never comfortable in the house mm-hmm. because it cannot supply enough. Mm-hmm. So this is the time that you do all these calculations and, you know, mix your cards together, I guess.
There you go.
Gotcha. Thank you so much. This is exactly the information I was looking for.
Thank you, Tim.
My pleasure.
Cheers. Have a good.
You too. Let's go to Norm. We have a few minutes for Norm. It's 9:42. Norm, you're in Point O'Trauma. You want to insulate the attic?
Yes. Good morning. My house is 10 years old. It's a townhouse. And I've recently measured the insulation, the blow-in insulation, and it seems to have settled to about 8 inches. Mm. I was wondering what the recommended amount of insulation in an attic is right now and which is the least expensive way to improve it.
R50 is today's code. So R50 is today's code. You know, provide you have the space for it, meaning I don't want you to add insulation if you are going to choke your attic. R50 is what the code requirements of today. It used to be R40 about 10 years ago. So that changed. That's why you probably have less than what you should in today's standards.
Okay.
Be careful, though. Ensure that you have the space not to block your soffits. We see that often, that people add insulation, but instead of helping their home, they really cause a lot of secondary damage, because if these soffits are blocked, then you're going to choke your attic and you're going to have all kind of problems that are going to happen, including mold and in the attic and ice buildup on the roof and so on and so forth. So just make sure that you have enough space. Make sure that the insulation expert that you're hiring, check your baffles through the whole perimeter of your soffits, mm-hmm. that it's well installed. And if you don't have some, install some. They really help, and they really help conserve the insulation from being blown around and moving. The cheapest option would be to add blown-in insulation above what you have.
Okay.
But they have to go through the house? That would be the cheapest and the fastest. No. They have to go just simply through your attic latch. That's it. That's all.
Okay. I noticed that there's baffles there, so they seem to go up almost 2 feet above the level along the rafters, above the level of the insulation. So then there shouldn't be any problem adding the insulation.
Absolutely not. I don't think you need more than 2 feet in today. That's for sure. You just need a few inches. So, if you probably add another 4 inches, you'll be good.
Okay.
Having said that, look at the whole perimeter, though, because sometimes you have areas, where the roof line is a bit lower and the angle is a bit more touchy.
Right.
These areas you want to maybe shoot less. So every roof line is different, and that's why you have to have a good technician who is blown in. You can't necessarily have R50 everywhere in all attics. You might have to compromise on R30 in one location just because the roof line is done badly, and then R50 in another location. That's fine.
Okay.
But no matter what you do, and specifically in these locations, do not block those the ventilation from the soffits.
Okay. And complementary to that, if I could.
Yeah.
I have a finished garage and a finished basement in the and the wall in between the garage and the basement, after doing a few renovations, I've noticed that it's not insulated. But I'd like to keep the garage colder, but it seems that my finished basement is supplying the heat to the garage. Is that normal code, or did they not respect the code when it was built?
Norm and Walter, you guys, you know what? Just hang on. We'll get to this in a second. We're going to just put the Norm on hold. We're going to get to traffic and come right back with this. And more calls, too, at 514-790-0800.
This is the Home Improvement Show on News Talk Radio, CJAD 800.
Certainly is. Ken Connors alongside Walter Assey from Renovco handling the calls at 514-790-0800. We're going to go back to Norm. Norm, we're just going to wrap up because you also had a question about insulating the garage.
Well, insulating the common wall between the garage and the finished basement.
Okay.
And I noticed during renovations that it wasn't insulated. I was wondering if it's respected code, and if even no matter what, I'd like to know if there's an easy way to insulate it.
I mean, okay, so it is more often than not, contractors will leave that wall out to cut costs. But it's a very, very, very bad idea.
I agree.
If you have a heated space, because typically you're not heating the garage at the same temperature as the rest of the house. It's usually at least 10 degrees lower, if not more. Right?
Right.
So that wall is essential to keep the heat in every room at the temperature that you want it to be. So exactly. If you have a room adjacent to the garage and you're at 25 and the garage is at 10, that heat is escaping that room and heating your garage and creating you way more bills in heating than you need. So it's really counterintuitive. What you should do is you think of your garage as a cube cooler. And, you know, if you have one part of that cooler that is not insulated, all these that heat and the warmth and the coldness and everything escapes. Same thing with your garage. It's super important that all these walls are insulated. All four walls are insulated, really. If not, you are spending a lot of more money than you should. And if you think you're saving money by decreasing the temperature in the garage, you're not, because you're heating it through the other rooms.
Mm.
The other thing that insulating that wall helps is a bit of sound dampening, because, you know, when we're in the garage, we might have a small workshop there, or, you know, starting the car in the morning on a cold day where, you know, it's you don't want to wake anybody up and so on and so forth. So that also helps. The third thing that I like the most is it actually reduces the amount of carbon monoxide emission that can get through the adjacent rooms, especially if you spray foam it.
Yeah.
So it kind of seals it, and you are ensuring that none of these fumes are coming into those rooms where you're sleeping or sitting watching TV or so on and so forth. So there's a lot of benefits.
Okay.
A lot of benefits. And you know, the easiest way, just to kind of answer your question, if you don't want to rip out those walls, you know, there are companies out there that will drill holes and they will just inject these holes from top to bottom with the insulation that you need.
Okay.
There you go.
That would be the easiest way.
So you don't have to take out. Yeah, that would be the easiest way. I mean, the other way would be to rip out everything and restart. But that might be expensive. And if you are going to do that, you have to decide which side have less things in it. For example, in a garage, don't forget, you need 5/8 Gibraltar, which is heavier and more expensive. So you might want to consider taking out the other drywall in the other room, because it's typically 1/2 inch.
Oh, okay.
So there are cost savings there, and it's easier to install. It's a lighter type drywall to install.
Very good.
And I wonder if I could get the blow foam insulation. Would that be easier?
Well, that could be done through both. Either the blown in is the only way actually you could do it. You can have batts, but I'm saying you can have it urethane or blown in. Either would work, not a problem, especially that it's an inside wall, so no vapor barrier is required as such. So fiberglass by itself is sufficient. It's fine.
Norm, we got to run.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good luck with that. Going to squeeze in Ryan out in Pierrefonds. Hi, Ryan.
Yes, good day. If you're putting a metal roof on an A-frame on the top, what color is the best that will not be eaten by the sun? Blue one or red
That's
one?
That's a very good question. Well, all the light colors are good. Any color that is light is good. Having said that, some manufacturers guarantee their colors for 50 years. So it depends on your manufacturer of steel as well. And, you know, it could be black, but it's still guaranteed. So I would look into the guarantee from the manufacturer first and foremost. So, you know, I would not, maybe if I tell you green and your whole house is a different color, it's going to look ridiculous, right? So look at the... look at the manufacturer's guarantees and don't worry so much about the color per se if it's going to affect the overlook of your house. So if black oak looks good on your house, find that manufacturer that gives you the longest type of warranty. And they, and you know, they come a long way right now. The painting application came a long way. So you'd be surprised. Like I said, I found one that actually gives 50 years warranty on color, which is a huge.
You've answered my question. Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan. Walter, I have about 2 minutes, and I have to apologize. Francine, we only have 2 minutes. You want to quickly ask your question?
Okay, just quickly. I had an inspector, and I know that the soffits on one side of my house are not open. Who do I hire to open them? And on the left-hand side, we cannot get into the on the roof at all. Do I open it? Do I break the walls to open it to see if the soffits are okay? I have no problems with the left-hand side of my house. It's the right-hand side. I continue to have icicles and floods, and I don't know who to hire for this.
So by code, every attic should have some type of a latch to access it somehow, okay?
The attic will go up to half of the roof. That's the problem,
That's right. But you can visually see what's going on the perimeter without necessarily walking on the perimeters. Am I correct?
I can see only what's going on half of the house where the attic, where we see the soffits, et cetera, and we know that they're blocked. We know that. We cannot see it on the other side of the house.
Yeah. So the other side of the house, because it's a split level, that way?
It's a bungalow. Yeah. Split level. Yes.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to tell you is in the section that does not have access to the attic, you might want to think about getting some type of a trap to go into the attic and see what's going on.
Okay.
It's very, very important. Just a question of cutting a square in your wall, some closet. Usually we prefer it to be more accessible, so it's in the ceiling of the bedroom. And that's what the new codes now. You're not allowed to put it in closets anymore because they want it to be way more accessible. You cut that, you have a latch, you put a styrofoam door on it and make sure it's well insulated and well sealed. And that gives you access to your attic and you see what's going on. That's number one. Number two, who to hire? Anybody, insulation companies can come and do that for you, no problem. They charge you a service charge.
They told me no. I called two insulation companies. They say we don't do soffits. We don't open soffits. I need to have the soffits opened also.
So try to call general contractors or roofers. Roofers might do that for you as well.
Very good. All right, Walter, we squeezed it in. Francine, thank you. We tried to get that in as best we could. Walter, thank you, and safe travels. We'll talk to you next Saturday morning. How's that?
Absolutely looking forward, but thank you so much. And have yourself a great weekend.
You too. 9:59 News is standing by. The latest from the CJD 800 Newsroom. And then Lisa's ready to go with the car show.